Hi, my name is Amy.
And my name is James.
And this is How I Learned to Love Shrimp, a podcast about promising ways to help animals and build the animal advocacy movement.
Today we speak to Nikunj Sharma, who is the CEO of Mercy for Animals India. We spoke about Mercy for Animals' work in India, the pros and cons of being a branch of a large international nonprofit like Mercy for Animals is, and the specific challenges and opportunities of doing animal advocacy work in India. Sadly, we had some microphone challenges in this episode, so our audio is not as good as we'd like it to be. That said, Nikunj had a power cut just as we started recording, so we're actually very happy we managed to speak to him at all. And we do value any and all feedback, so if you do have feedback on our questions, audio quality, guests, or anything else, please do contact us on our website at howilearnedtoloveshrimp.com. Without further ado, here is the actual episode.
Hi, everyone. So today we're joined by Nikunj Sharma, Chief Executive Officer of Mercy for Animals India. He's an ardent animal rights activist with over 15 years of experience in the sector. Throughout his journey, Nikunj has dedicated his life to advocating for the well-being and ethical treatment of animals. Nikunj hails from New Delhi in India. He's a trained social worker and a lawyer by profession. Welcome, Nikunj.
Thank you so much, Amy and James, for having me on the podcast. Really excited.
Thanks for being here. So we're just going to kick off with the first question, which is a bit of an icebreaker. So what's an animal-related view that you have changed your mind on recently, and why?
I won't say something that I have changed my mind recently. But just before I joined Mercy for Animals, it's just that I now have a strong feeling of working for farmed animals than some other animals. And by saying that, I don't mean that other animals are not important or need less attention. But I feel that there are very few organizations that are working on farmed animals, and MFA is one of those. The reason why I changed my view on this is because of the sheer number of animals that struggle in factory farms across the globe and also in India. For example, in India, more than 40 crore hens are languishing in battery cages. Nearly 1 crore pigs are confined in gestation crates. And around 13 million metric tons of fish are produced or caught in India. So I believe that one policy change has the power to create a positive impact to the lives of millions and billions of animals in India and globally. And hence, I feel that farm animal causes need all the more support in terms of resources to move ahead and put up a strong fight for animals.
Just one thing to clarify, I think you use crore, which means 10 million. Is that right?
Yeah, that's always very tricky to actually convert. So 10 million is 1 crore.
Got it. Yeah. Cool. That makes sense.
Wow. Huge. And is that a recent change for you, prioritizing farmed animals?
I think prioritizing farm animals just before I joined Mercy for Animals. Before that, I was working on all animals, animals in entertainment, animals in experimentation, animals used for food. But yeah. I think this recent change has come after I actually, started applying for Mercy for Animals. And when I started reading, I would say that, I was also not aware that so many animals are just being abused for food in India.
Right.
So when I learned about the sheer number of animals that struggle in this sector, I was moved and I thought that probably this is where, my expertise and in fact the resources from around the globe should, be more focused on.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think many people are in a similar position where you've probably worked a bit more broadly across animals. I remember attending the Asia for Animals conference in China in 2019, and there wasn't really a farmed animal sort of section within the conference at that point, whereas now there's going to be a whole day kind of dedicated to farmed animal work in the region. So I think many advocates will be in a fairly similar position to you. And it's amazing now that we have, like you said, your expertise coming into this field and helping the most animals possible.
And on that, so you've obviously been involved in the animal space for quite a while. And so what were you doing before you joined MFA? MFA being Mercy for Animals, of course. And how did you end up being the CEO of Mercy for Animals India?
Oh, I sometimes feel that holidaying can bring a lot back to you. So I would say that if I was not holidaying that summer, I would not have been in the position. I was holidaying with a friend, and that's when he told me that MFA is looking for a CEO position to basically establish their India entity. that's when I spoke to a lot of friends in the global movement and heard a lot about Mercy for Animals culture, especially having their focus on diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice. I also read their three-year plans to find out how focused and impact-driven Mercy for Animals strategies and goals were. And that's when I decided that I would like to contribute to the cause of farmed animals, working for an organization that not just cares for animals, but also deeply cares for humans. So I appeared in about 4 rounds of interviews, after which I was finally appointed as the first CEO of Mercy for Animals India Foundation. And it's been 3 years since I joined MFA India. And I can happily say that today that I made probably one of the best decisions of my life by applying for this position.
Wow. Nice. So we should all go on more holidays, right? That's the takeaway from that. You never know who you might come across.
Absolutely.
Very cool.
And so what's the main focus of your work right now?
As you know, that Mercy for Animals globally focuses only on farmed animals because, as I said, of just sheer number of animals exploited in that sector.
Right.
And India has the largest livestock population in the world. We are one of the largest producers of milk, eggs, shrimp, fish, and hence our role becomes very important to touch on all these issues. However, currently we are focusing on having gestation and farrowing trades prohibited across India. I'm happy to share with you that in just 1+ year of our campaign, so far nearly 22 out of the 36, Indian states have prohibited the production, sale, and use of gestation and farrowing trades in India.
I'm just going to clarify. So is it a bit like when you say in the state, in the regions, is it a bit broken down a bit like the US or in Switzerland where it's the cantons where the legislation or the work that you have to do is to get each individual region to agree to something?
Yeah. So basically agriculture and so to say animal husbandry is legally, if you ask, it's a state subject in the Indian constitution. So the states can legislate on any subject that's listed as a state subject in the constitution. And animal husbandry is one of that subject. So that's why we approached with the strategy that we're going to ask each of the states to start prohibiting. And when we actually got the first ban, second ban, third ban, that's when we started going to other states saying that, hey, listen, these three have banned. Would you also like to ban? And that's when we gained the momentum. Where states started to think that, oh, if they can do, we can do. And then there is also kind of, if you think strategically in India, there are also kind of states. It was a one state and then it was bifurcated into two states. So they were one state at one point of time and now they're neighbors. So there is also that kind of a bit of a, you can say a friendly rivalry where they want to do what the other state has done. So they would say that, oh, our sister state has banned it, why can't we ban it?
Yeah.
So we went by that approach. So based on that, India has, I guess I may be wrong, but I think we have 36 or 38 Indian states and Union territories, out of which 22 have already banned it.
Great.
And the issue has also drawn support from celebrities in the Bollywood. In India, I mean, everyone knows that Bollywood and cricket is something that's most followed. And we got some big Bollywood celebrities. John Ibrahim is a very big name in the Indian film industry. And he came to us after he learned about the plight of pigs in gestation farrowing crates. So we got him to write a letter to the Indian government urging them to ban gestation farrowing crates across India by using their central powers. And then apart from this, we are also collaborating with other groups and working to get better welfare standards put up in place for animals raised in the dairy industry. We have also recently signed a memorandum of understanding with Fish Welfare Initiative in India because fish welfare is also one of the focus areas for Mercy for Animals globally because India produces both inland and wild caught fish in huge numbers. So it becomes a focus area for us. We have just signed this MOU to so that we can work on improving the welfare standards for fish in India.
Very cool. And just one question on the gestation crate victory. So in terms of actually kind of convincing the various state departments to agree to this, what kind of tactics are you using to kind of pressure them and get them to agree?
Happy to answer that. So there were various tactics that we used. In fact, some of the tactics completely, India being a unique region, some of the things completely differ. For example, and I'm going to talk about this more in the podcast as we move ahead in some of the questions. So for example, I learned from many of my colleagues and friends in the global movement that, you know, we send a letter and we get a response. We send a meeting request and we get a response, whether yes or a no. But in India, it's kind of very different. You may send out a meeting request and you never get a response. But what works in India is that you go to a government public office, you sit outside their office, give your card, wait for the public meeting time of the officer, meet with them, explain the matter to them, and then the file moves forward. So from sitting outside the offices of the government officers for days and weeks to building pressure from by the, you know, activists on ground, by doing demonstrations, protests also on ground, and also by using some of the power of celebrities. I would say these were some of the tactics that we used to get these bans in place.
Very cool. That sounds very similar to what Emre from Kafesiz in Turkey said, where if you send a letter and email, they won't reply to you. So you have to go to their office and knock on their door and say, hey, we want to meet with you. So it sounds like a similar challenge you guys are facing.
Wow. I'm happy to learn that there are countries which are like India.
Yeah, definitely.
And how big's the Mercy for Animals India team, just to clarify? So you came on a few years ago. Has the team expanded since then?
Yes. So we started with just a one-person team when I started. So I was the only one joining. So right now we are a team of 7 people. And out of these, we have 5 full-time team members and 2 consultants.
Okay.
And we are hoping to expand in the next year.
Nice.
Very cool. And generally, I think MFA has on their website that you have a 3-part strategy, which touches on making alternatives better and more accessible, making animal products less attractive, and also reducing current suffering in the food system, such as by improving welfare standards, like you said, through gestation crates or their industry. And out of these, which ones does MFA India focus on the most? And yeah, how do you kind of choose which one to prioritize, at least within the Indian context?
Well, it's very hard to choose one because we are the ones who have set these priorities. So, but yeah, if you ask me personally, I am very interested in making alternatives better and more accessible. I'll tell you the reason, because I have been a vegan for almost 16 years now, and I have seen how difficult it was to choose from only a couple of vegan milk and tofu options in India. But in these 16 years, I've also seen a major shift in people's food choices, thereby making vegan foods more attractive and a healthier option. However, I still feel that the price needs to compete with dairy options. And in order to do that, I feel that a multi-stakeholder approach where plant-based companies, governments, think tanks, and international organizations come together to incentivize the plant-based businesses so that they could reach a price parity with dairy options. So yeah, I would say my personal interest would be to make alternatives better and more accessible to the general public.
Is that something that MFA India is working on actively in terms of promoting alternatives like alternative proteins and other foods?
We haven't started, I would say, exactly the same work, but how we are working right now in our corporate department is we've just started the corporate work, and we are trying to get more of vegan options available, say, by way of airlines or cinema halls or Indian Railways. We recently had good meetings with some airline companies and Indian Railways to include more of vegan options. We already have plant-based options in India available almost everywhere, but what we don't have is to have more of vegan options. In fact, there are certain things like which are by default vegan. So for example, there is a very popular dish in India which is had for breakfast. It's called as a poha, which is by default vegan and which is also served in airlines. The only problem is that it's not labeled as vegan. So we've also given that idea to the airline companies that, you know, if you make just clarify that this is a vegan product in your menu, it will open probably, you know, like your sales to all the vegan customers as well, who may not know otherwise that this was a vegan product.
And has veganism had like a similar trajectory to what I feel like it has in Europe and maybe the US, where just over the last few years it has really expanded? Do you have any figures or understanding of the kind of general population approach or numbers to do with veganism?
There's this recent news article which I was reading, and it was about a survey which said that 67% of Indians are more likely to have vegan products. In fact, there is another one undated news article that I can think of which said that in the past 10 years, veganism has grown 300% in India. So, and as I said, I've being in the moment, I'm seeing this, the rise of veganism in India. A lot of, so earlier when I used to go to schools and colleges, like veganism was such an alien concept. Like people would not.
Yeah.
It's like often confused in India because in India, you have like predominantly vegetarian people. So they'll be like, okay, vegan vegetarian is the same.
Yeah.
But I have seen this major shift happening in, you know, people's understanding. In fact, also thanks to, you know, companies like Netflix and other OTT platforms, those who are coming in, that it's also kind of, you know, some of the series that I watch, it talks about, you know, that, oh, I'm vegan. Here and there, they mention the term veganism. And all the youngsters in India watch Netflix or Amazon Prime Video or some other OTT platform, which I would say has also helped in, you know, creating a perception, positive perception around veganism in India.
Yeah, it's just integrating it into the mainstream, isn't it? And then it's just normalizing it across the board.
Absolutely. In fact, about 10 years ago, we did not have many Indian film industry actors who were vegan. But now it's so easy to find vegan celebrities in India, and some of those who are also associated with MFA. And in some of the popular TV programs also, these celebrities have come forward and said that the reason why they have turned vegan, for of course, for animal welfare and for their own health. So it's now becoming more streamlined, and I would say people are becoming more aware of the concept of veganism than it was 10 years ago.
Right.
It's interesting, you do a fair amount of both legislative work and protest, and actually, do you think that affects how the government treats you? Or because usually I think groups will do one or the other. So I think it's interesting you do both at the same time. And yeah, how do you manage that?
I think it's absolutely fine. I think the government is tolerant to, you know, a certain level of protests that are being done on the ground. And I think these are all campaigns that we do. If you're doing protests, they're all, you know, very peaceful protests. And they're more of creative protests. So for example, last time we had a protest on World Vegan Month about, you know, phasing out battery cages. We had these volunteers, female volunteers, who got into cages and with the taglines reading that hens suffer in cages. So these are like very, very creative, eye-catching campaigns that even the media likes to cover. So when these kind of campaigns reach the news the next day, all the you know, the policymakers, bureaucrats, and all the stakeholders do look at these campaigns. It also kind of, you know, generates an idea that, oh, this is an issue which needs to be you know, thought about. And any of our street demonstrations or campaigns are always followed with the policy actions. For example, if we have done something today, we are going to send a letter about this tomorrow to the relevant ministry, so that it has a recall value for them as well.
It's interesting that you say that the media are kind of on board in sharing the work and the protests, especially if it's something more creative. Do you feel like that's helped the public perception of the organization or your work?
I think it generally helps the entire campaign, I would say, because whenever we have done these campaigns, you know, we start getting calls on our landline number, we start getting messages on Instagram, and that's how we kind of figure out that, oh, we have made some impact by doing that one demonstration. Plus, there are a lot of people. So whenever we do these campaigns at places which are generally surrounded by a lot of people, so that a lot of awareness can be created. And we have seen a lot of people joining us then and there by signing petitions, you know, and by becoming our volunteers. So our volunteer base is also increasing because of these campaigns. So yes, it does, you know, has a positive impact on building the brand image. And also it helps broadly the entire campaign.
That's great. And is there any pushback from the industry? Do they have an opportunity to respond to press articles or kind of noise that's created around the campaigns? Do you often have retorts from them?
Sometimes, yes. Especially by the dairy industry. There have been instances where the dairy industry has come out by giving full-page ads on why it's important to drink milk.
Right.
And these are like front page ads, which cost like lakhs and lakhs of rupees. But of course, since as a nonprofit, we don't have that kind of funds. So we believe in earned media. So, but it also kind of makes us realize that, yes, our work is, you know, making the industry think that there is something wrong. So I take it with, you know, that positivity that if the industry is responding, that means they are, you know, it's hurting them somewhere. So that makes me think.
Yeah, if they're having to justify on a full page spread costing millions, then yeah, for sure, you're obviously stirring up something. Interesting.
Cool. And just maybe moving on to Mercy for Animals more broadly, I guess I'm quite interested to ask about how, this question of organizations that are global like Mercy for Animals setting up new kind of branches, so to speak, or offices in countries such as India or other places versus organizations locally starting that are maybe not under that umbrella. And do you have a sense of the pros and cons of this? And yeah, how has that affected your work being related to Mercy for Animals globally versus not maybe being there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, Mercy for Animals is expanding globally. We have an entire team that's looking into international expansion. And we like to think that, you know, both the pros and cons are complementary. So having a global organization with presence in multiple countries has its advantage of bringing the expertise, infrastructure, cross-learning opportunities and resources into new countries. So that's a pro. Mm. At the same time, there is the risk of people's perception that a global organization does not know how to operate in a different country, especially in regions with a very different socioeconomic context compared to the headquarters. But Mercy for Animals, I would say, is very mindful of that. And we have created a system to ensure autonomy to the regions while also guaranteeing that the global strategic alignment, prioritization, and values are still there. And we also believe that global organizations founded in well-resourced countries are more able to allocate these resources into countries with a bigger potential impact, which is the case of MFA. So I feel that, you know, a well-resourced organization like Mercy for Animals, they're investing in India, which is a less resourced country. That's a pro for the region and for animals. And we've also experienced that collaboration between different organizations, local and multinational, can benefit both and make them grow. So that's also a pro when you know, international organizations are expanding in India. Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, so the headquarters are in the US, that's right. It's headed in the US.
Yes.
And maybe leading on from that as well, how do you think this affects how you're treated by the government or stakeholders? Is there more like distrust or cautiousness if you're perceived as a global organization, or have you not encountered that to a big degree?
You know, it varies a lot from country to country. But in general, if I were to talk about Mercy for Animals, we are very respected and valued in the countries we are in. Mm. Given our good reputation and history internationally. So most stakeholders receive us well, especially in the government. Yes, we share a very, very cordial relation with the government in the regions.
Mm. Mm. Cool. And then maybe another one on that is, it seems like all the signs I've heard from MFA's expansion is that it's gone pretty well. Like you said, they're very kind of want to respect autonomy within the regions and countries and want to like empower people rather than dictate stuff. And if you had to kind of provide some tips on the organizations that do expand internationally, what do you think are the top tips on how they should do this well or what they should not do, basically?
Well, to start with, I'm no expert on this, but I'm happy to share my views on that. I would say that make sure the team leading the work is from that particular country.
Mm.
And at MFA, we believe a recipe for failure is when decisions are made in a country by people who do not understand the social context. So that would be my first advice. The second advice would be to ensure that there is autonomy in the decision-making process in the countries you are expanding to. At the same time, ensure they make decisions with the values and core principles of the organizations. And also to ensure that they set good goals and they have a good accountability process. That's the second tip from my side. And the third tip from my side would be to ensure that you're highly collaborative with the local organizations and generally demonstrate the desire to support them however needed. In India, we are MFA's, one of the core values is being collaborative. So in India, we are collaborating with almost every local organization, whether big or small. We have the intent to collaborate with all the organizations. We are not able to collaborate, I would say, with all the organizations, but most of the organizations. And that's also one of the reasons why in just a very short span of 3 years, MFA India has been able to achieve what it could. And I would completely give the credit of this to collaborating with local organizations. I don't think we would have achieved what we have achieved today without the support of local organizations. And I think last tip would be to provide the necessary infrastructure from the global headquarters, including financial systems, resources, support teams, etc.
Yeah, that's got to be such a benefit to just have all of that set up already and not need to worry about, you know, infrastructure and dealing with, different processes and procedures. If that's already just taken care of off the bat, I think that, that's got to be a huge advantage. And I agree. I feel like having someone who's from the country, living in the country, I think that's such a huge, a huge one to make sure that there is that local country context. How many other organizations are working specifically on farmed animals in the region?
In India, Mosquito Animals is the only organization that's working on just farm animals.
Okay. So other groups are maybe have a couple of projects on or join you on like gestation crates and things, but they're not solely just on farmed animals.
Right. So there are organizations who are working on gestation crates, battery cages, but at the same time, they're working on spaying and neutering of dogs. They're also working on working animals. They're also working on animal experimentation and other issues, so on and so forth. But Mosquito Animals is the only organization in India that's only focusing on farm animal welfare.
Interesting. From a public perspective, what's the biggest sort of animal issue nationally? Is there something that the public care most about when it comes to animal welfare?
I think it's kind of political and religious both, but people seem to care most about cows in India because of the religious angle.
Yeah.
But I think they're just not aware of, what exactly happens in the dairy industry. So another reason why people care more about cows is because 90% of the milk that's consumed in India, produced in India, is that of buffalo milk. Cow milk is around 9-10%. So cow being the minority and also, having a religious angle to it, I think that's one area where people care about why they care about cows more. I would say the other area where where people are more concerned about is about street animals. Because India has a lot of stray animal population. And then of course there are issues associated with it, accidents and injuries and other things. So I think people see an injured animal and that moves them very fast, if you ask about funds, that kind of impulsive giving happens more in, for injured animals than that of farm animals, because of course farm animal suffering is not something that's visible. But if they're seeing an elephant or a tiger performing a trick in a circus, or a buffalo or a bull carrying heavy loads on the streets of Delhi, that's kind of visible cruelty that they see and they instantly relate to it. And that's where I think the role of farm animal organizations come in, where we want to actually tell people that, what you don't see does not mean there is no cruelty in that. And we are trying to make people see all the cruelty that's happening in factory farms across India.
Yeah, of course. Just that exposure, isn't it? It's the same across the board. I think the industry have got away for quite a while with just it being behind closed doors. In terms of that India specificity then, what are the unique challenges that you face as an organization working in India?
Yeah, there are many actually. And I can actually just start with the first one, which a lot of colleagues in the movement also resonate with, which is that the market is informal, which makes it very unique in terms of having a policy framed and implemented. For example, unlike the US and many other countries where people buy from supermarkets, one commitment from Whole Foods or a Walmart on procuring cage-free eggs can change the entire game.
Mm-hmm. But
in India, the people like to buy food from small shops, open wet markets, which makes it very difficult to first procure and then have the commitment implemented. But I also see an opportunity here that at least in the most metro cities in India, like Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai, Kolkata, we're seeing a rise in the supermarket culture. And I see it as an opportunity to start talking to these supermarkets and start procuring commitments, like you know how globally commitments are procured. So market being informal is a major, major challenge. Another challenge is, again, a lot of animal rights activists in the movement resonate with me, is that of implementation of a policy. So we have some of the best laws in India, but challenge remains on is that of on-ground implementation.
Right.
So, for example, now that we have gestation crates ban, we, as an organization with very less resources, we will only have to ensure that the ban is implemented. It's not that it goes on an autopilot mode that, oh, a ban has come into place, the authorities will take care of it now. We just going to, you know, shut the campaign and just focus on something else. But, you know, that's not the case. We may have to hire enforcement officers who are going to go to each of these states, look at farms, whether the ban has been implemented or not. So, yeah, having the policy and having the policy implemented are two different things in India, which is also a major challenge. But the groups are working to resolve this by, as I said, appointing on-ground officers to ensure implementation. And we are also trying to build capacities of the law enforcement officers on ground to ensure that they understand the law and implement it. So these are about challenges. In terms of opportunity, I say that I see there is plenty of opportunities working for animals in India. And I think the plant-based sector is still at its nascent stage. Cultivated meat has not been explored. And having seen India leading the world in making some of the best policies for animals, including banning the testing of cosmetics on animals, so I feel that there are plenty of opportunities that lie ahead of the movement. And one thing that I would really like to see India focusing on would be cultivated meat.
Very cool. And do you focus on cultivated because you think the current plant-based alternatives may not reach the level that consumers want, or you think there's more like desire for cultivated meat within the Indian population, or what was that particular reason for that decision?
I think the plant-based alternatives in India, I think they also need to, you know, like the plant-based alternatives that I have, I eat in the United States, they taste much closer, although some of the companies in India have done a brilliant job in actually mocking the same taste and texture of that of meat. But I think there is still that apprehension among the meat eaters that it's not meat. You know, so it's like, and in terms of cultivated meat, why I say that from a consumer's point of view is that if they get something which is real meat, and they know that it's not causing animal suffering and it's not causing any environmental damage, I feel that people are more you know, receptive to cultivated meat. Although having said that, plant-based meats are again some of the best in India that you know that are coming up, and there are so many companies that are you know launching plant-based meats. I have always been a vegetarian. There was once I ate I was actually gifted a sample product by one of the companies, and I started cooking that at home. And my mom said, "Who's cooking chicken in the house?" I was like, "This is not chicken." My mom was like, "This is something non-vegetarian for sure." I said, "No, it's not." So it has reached that much close. So I would say that, you know, plant-based alternatives are growing in India, but I think if we also have some sort of investments, research, put in cultivated meat, I think that won't harm you. I think that's only going to benefit it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, well, I think there's so many groups doing work on alternative proteins in India. I think, to my knowledge, I think there's GFI India, but the Good Food Institute India. But I think besides that, it seems like as one of the largest countries in the world by population, it seems like there's lots more work that could be done. So it seems like a white space.
Do you find that with India being such a large producer, that also changes the way in which you are having to approach this type of work? I know in other regions where actually production within the country might be fairly low, but imports are quite a big issue. And so that takes up quite a bit of focus. Do you also look at, as a producer, then exporting, you know, eggs, fish, chicken? How does that change the angle and the emphasis that you put on certain areas of your work?
India's status as one of the world's largest producer of eggs, fish, chicken, along with its projected population growth, does have implications for various aspects related to animals and sustainability. I think the first one is, of course, animal welfare, because with a significant number of animals being raised and consumed in India, it becomes crucial to prioritize their welfare. Ensuring humane and ethical treatment of animals throughout their lives, including their rearing, transportation, slaughter, is, of course, an important consideration. And also, it is essential for governments, organizations, and individuals to promote and even practices that minimize the suffering of animals. So that's definitely one aspect of it, how I see it. Then sustainable practices, I think, you know, large-scale production of eggs, fish, and chicken, they now demand responsible and sustainable practices, because sustainable farming techniques such as improved animal husbandry, efficient resource utilization, waste management, and reduced use of antibiotics, for that matter, can help mitigate environmental impact. So I think encouraging environmentally friendly practices is crucial to minimize the ecological footprint associated with animal agriculture. And again, as I said, India now officially being the world's most populous country in the world, food security is a major challenge. And meeting the nutritional needs of a growing population like India while balancing environmental concerns is a complex challenge. I have to admit that. And it definitely calls for a strategic planning, research, and as I said, innovation in agricultural practices like cultivated meat to ensure sustainable food production and distribution systems. And one area where I saw a major change in thinking is that of public health. Because soon after the COVID pandemic, people started to draw the link between animal agriculture, meat production, and public health. As animal production intensifies, it is important to address potential public health concerns for sure. And I have seen a major change in thinking of some public health organizations as well. In fact, Mercyful Animals has signed a memorandum of understanding with a big public health institute called as the George Institute of Global Health to set up a center for One Health research. And in that, basically, we plan to strengthen the research around zoonotic diseases in India, and want to ensure that the safety of animal products for human consumption. And I think investing in robust veterinary healthcare systems and promoting responsible antimicrobial use are also essential for protecting public health, which is something that has seen a lot of change. And I won't go into ethical consideration because we all know what the ethical considerations are for this. But in summary, I would say that India's significant role as a producer of eggs, fish, chicken, coupled with projected population growth, it underscores the need for sustainable and ethical practices in animal agriculture. And of course, balancing food security, animal welfare, environmental impact, and public health concerns will require collaborative efforts from various stakeholders, along with the exploration of innovative solutions to meet the evolving needs of a growing and big growing population like India.
How much control do you have over exports? Is it that policies can apply also to India just being a large producer? Do you have a certain amount of control over what the welfare measures are that is for products that are predominantly exported?
Honestly, I haven't really looked into it, but organizations like Shrimp Welfare that have now started working in India, Fish Welfare who have now started in India, and a major part of shrimp and fish are exported out of India. And I know that they're working on some of the export angle into it. But what I feel in terms of export, I think the countries where we're exporting to, like for example, the European Union, they have very stringent welfare standards. And I believe that working with those countries to ensure that the animals that are, you know, like raised, farmed in India meet the proper welfare standards, I think working with those countries may have even more impact because they are the ones who are the buyers, and buyers can always have the first say than the seller. So right. I believe that, you know, working with the importing countries would be, you know, would make a major impact in the negotiations around animal welfare.
Are you actually seeing that in practice? Are you seeing that because Europe have higher welfare standards and they import a lot from India, that farmers are having to change practices because they sell to Europe and other areas that have higher standards?
Yes, I'm assuming that, yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
And you mentioned before that the systems of sale for animal products within India are fairly informal, you said, through, you know, wet markets or smaller scale shops. I'm wondering, like, what is the production systems like in India in terms of, to what degree is there lots of smallholder farms or many of them, or is it kind of like the US system, quite big kind of mega farms, factory farms? And yeah, I'm wondering what that looks like in India.
Right. Mm. That's a very good question. In fact, I was just before this podcast having a similar discussion with one of our longtime friends, and they were asking me about dairy farms, how dairy farms work. So I would start with that only. Recently, we you know, heard the news of about 18,000 cows dying in a dairy farm in the US because of the explosion. In India, you would rarely find a farm as big as that. In India, it's mostly smaller farms. So in fact, most of the farms work on a cooperative model, especially if I have to talk about dairy. They work on a cooperative model where you have small farms which have small produce. And they would collect the entire produce and deposited to a collection center, and from the collection center it goes to the main the production unit, and then the milk is processed and then it's packaged and sold to different markets. So in India, that's, again, as I said, market is informal, and this is also one of the challenges where you do not have like, you know, very organized kind of production system, especially if you were to talk about milk. However, it differs for poultry somewhere, because you have like some big poultry farms and also controlled by some big companies. So yeah, the production system is fairly, I would say, unorganized and, you know, small production, you know, kind of adding up to the bigger, you know, production is something that happens more in India.
Mm. And do you see this changing over time? Do you see more consolidation of the small farms into larger farms, or is this not really happening?
I don't see that happening in the near future, because we have recently, a couple of years ago in India, they have started a new government ministry called as the Ministry of Cooperation, which means this ministry is solely responsible for promoting cooperatives in India. And some of the biggest cooperatives in India are dairy cooperatives, poultry cooperatives. So I don't see that happening in the near future.
And so the cooperatives are where one company or leader sort of owns many of the individual smallholder farms underneath. And so they're feeding into them as a sort of within the production line. They're like a step before them as the cooperative as a main producer.
Correct. And a lot of farmers are a part of a cooperative.
Right. And so I guess having a department, is that giving them kind of, does that help you at all? Are they given like more protection so that's more difficult to get to them? Or is it easier that you can then just target the head of that cooperation as a, you know, a corporate target to get them to then filter down back into the small holdings to change their practices?
I think these departments are set up to, you know, help the farmers, maybe incentivize them as much as they can. So I don't see that kind of helping us, but I think these departments are primarily set to help the farmers to, you know, help them produce more.
And you mentioned before about the special roles that kind of cows have within Indian society. And actually, I didn't even know that most milk came from buffaloes in India. I'm wondering, how else does religion within India affect how animals are viewed and your work and how you need to message or communicate your advocacy?
Huh. That's again a very interesting and a very tricky question to answer. The interaction between animal advocacy, religion, and caste in India is a complex and multifaceted issue, I would say. India is a country which is very diverse with diverse religious beliefs and practices, and it is home to various caste and subcaste, each with its own cultural and social dynamics. So these factors can influence attitudes towards animals and shape the entire landscape in which animal advocacy operates. So I think understanding these dynamics is very important for addressing the implications they may have on promoting animal welfare. I would first talk about religious beliefs. So as I said, religion plays a significant role in shaping people's attitudes towards animals in India. And Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, among other religions, promote teachings of compassion and nonviolence towards all living beings. And these religions advocate for protection and animal and welfare of animals, which can align with animal advocacy efforts. However, interpretations and practices within religions can vary, and not all adherents may adhere strictly to these principles. So religious and beliefs can absolutely play a role. And there's, you know, rituals and practices. And we are talking on a day when Eid al-Adha is being celebrated across the globe. And Eid al-Adha is also called as Bakra Eid in India, which essentially means that goats are slaughtered to celebrate the festival. So yes, there are certain religious rituals and practices in India that involve animals, such as animal sacrifices or the use of animal products in some religious ceremonies. So balancing religious freedom and animal welfare can be a delicate issue. I recommend encouraging dialogue and education about alternative practices that respect animal welfare and can help foster understanding and potentially lead to the adoption of more compassionate approaches. So to answer your question, I think it's very complex. And of course, to also talk about caste system when we're talking about it, the caste system, although officially abolished in India, still influences social structures and interactions in India. Certain castes may traditionally be involved in, say, for example, occupations related to animal husbandry or butchery. This can affect the perception of animals and the attitudes towards animal advocacy within these communities. So I would say recognizing and respecting cultural practices while promoting animal welfare can also be a challenge that requires sensitivity and community engagement. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it's extremely interesting. And like you said, very, very complex with so many different groups and subgroups. Being in the largest country in the world, I can imagine so many different demographics and contexts. It's hard to operate in. So I guess good luck. I can imagine you have a tough job.
I think in a nutshell, I can say that it's essential to approach the topic of animal advocacy in India with cultural sensitivity and respect for diverse religious beliefs and caste dynamics. I also feel that providing information that acknowledges the religious and cultural context while promoting animal welfare and ethical considerations can help foster a more inclusive and constructive dialogue. I also believe that, you know, offering insights into religious teachings and encourage compassion towards animals and exploring alternative practices that align with religious beliefs can contribute to a more nuanced understanding and engagement within animal advocacy in India.
Yeah, makes sense. Great. Very interesting insight into the challenges that you face in the region. We're just going to move on to some sort of more general questions about you personally and some closing questions about how we might be able to ask our listeners to support Mercy for Animals in India. So the first one here then is, what is a view that you hold that perhaps most animal advocates would disagree with?
You know what, while reading this question, I kind of knew that, you know, they're tricking me into something.
No tricking, I promise.
And my friends at the moment, I may not be very happy with what I'm going to say about it. So I thought and thought and thought about this, and I thought of approaching this with the big smile and laughter, but this is a tough one, I would say. And I would say that this view of mine that most animal advocates disagree with, but something that I tell young animal rights activists is that your aggression should reflect in your writing than in physical form. I am a Gandhian, and I believe that only peace can bring peace, and that people will understand you if you listen to the reason why they are doing something. I have been a part of, and I'm saying this from my experience of, you know, when I have put all my aggression on paper. I have been a part of some of the biggest landmark victories, luckily, for animals in India in the past 15, 16 years of my career. And they were all achieved in a peaceful manner by using various tools of social change, such as mobilizing people, using the courts of law, and working with the states and federal governments with peaceful demonstrations. So my advice, I would say to all the young advocates, is that be as aggressive as you want to on paper. Fight for animals with a pen and paper in your hand, and I'm sure you're going to win.
Very, very inspiring words. I'm inspired. I'm like, that's great. Yeah, that's very cool. I think that's very, very wise advice. And thinking of either the global picture or working in India specifically, what kind of campaigns, programs, or new projects do you wish people were working on?
I wish more people, especially tech startups, were working on cultivated media. As I said, I think by now you would have known that Nikunj has a special interest for cultivated media. So I wish more people, especially tech startups, they were working on cultivated media. I mean, I'm excited about it, and I see that as the future. And if gone right, it may be helpful in eliminating big animal suffering across the globe. That's probably the reason countries like Singapore and recently the US SDA has given approval to lab-grown meat. In fact, Mercy for Animals was invited when we were in Singapore to taste the first lab-grown meat in Singapore. And Mercy for Animals team did that. And it was they found it as part of the team. And the team members who did that, of course, I didn't do it deliberately because I've never eaten meat and I was not very excited about tasting meat, which is really. But colleagues who did that, they said that it's part breaking in terms of taste, texture, everything. So I wish more people are working on in India, even the governments, think tanks. They are more, even the venture capitalists are investing more into cultivated startups.
Is it something you think MFA would ever venture into in India, like starting up a sort of incubator, a bit like the something like what ProVeg International, or is it 50 by 40, I'm not sure. There's like an incubation that helps organizations get off the ground. Do you think Mercy for Animals would ever venture into something like that?
I'm not sure. Maybe this is something that I need to check with the HQ.
On the lowdown. I see. So you've mentioned the sort of landmark passing of cultivated meat in the US. Is there any other news that you're excited about recently that you think is really kind of shaping the movement right now?
I think it's the same report that I mentioned in one of the previous questions. It's a report by the Plant-Based Food Industry Association. And they found that plant-based eating is becoming increasingly common in the country. They released this report at this year's Plant-Based Food Summit, and the report cites a survey which found that 67% of those who choose plant-based products are motivated by animal welfare issues, and 54% of people cite environmental concerns, while 48% believe that plant-based foods have health benefits. So this is the news that I was very excited about.
It's an interesting way around. Is that different to like Veganuary stats? Do you know, James? I feel like normally it's kind of health and environment, and then animals are a bit later. It feels interesting to me that it's that way around.
Potentially, I'm not too sure on the Veganuary stats, but I guess like we spoke about, given India's kind of higher focus on animal welfare relative to other countries, that could definitely be that way around. So that's quite interesting. But we'll definitely link that in the show notes if you want to read the article. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
And well, kind of leading on quite nicely from that, actually, is in terms of media recommendations for listeners, are there any books, podcasts, articles you'd recommend that people read just can be animal related or can be general life related?
I think life related, I have just started listening to Jay Shetty. And it's kind of, I like him. I don't know, but I like him. I just like to listen to him. He's like, he's just very practical and talks complete sense, you know. And it's like when I'm working out and I'm listening to him, I feel very good. The other recommendation, I'm also a book person, not a very podcast person. This Jay Shetty podcast is something that I've just started with, but I'm more of a book person. And so I can recommend two books. One is No Rules, Netflix and the Culture of Reinvention. And this basically talks about the culture of feedback and how important feedback is, you know, in an office environment, or, you know, even with colleagues, even in your family, how important it is to give and receive feedback. And it also talks about the art of giving feedback and also the art of receiving feedback. So I really enjoyed reading this book. And there's another book that I have just got from Amazon, I think last week. Haven't had the chance to read it, but it's a book that a friend and a colleague has recommended to me. It's titled as Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. And I hear very good reviews about this book. So yeah, I'm going to recommend that as well to the listeners.
What's the premise of that one?
I don't know much about it, but what I know about this book is it's basically training your mind and body to basically not get hurt, I guess.
I get another feedback.
Training your mind and body that you are not hurt by everything. So it can probably help you filter that.
Interesting. Yeah.
Very cool.
And how can people get more involved in Mercy for Animals India or general Mercy for Animals work? Are you hiring at the moment? I know you were talking about recruiting volunteers for campaigns. Is that ongoing? Where can people find out more information about how to help?
Absolutely. We'd be happy for people to join Mercy for Animals. As far as hirings are concerned, we are full with the hirings for this year. But I would recommend people to keep looking at mercyforanimals.in, which is our official website, for job opportunities. We also post job opportunities on LinkedIn, so you can follow me. I always share jobs that are open at MFA India. As far as being a volunteer is concerned, you can just send out an email to us on info@mercyforanimals.in. And with your details, name, email ID, phone numbers, and whenever there is a next action happening, either in your city or maybe across India, we are going to share information with you for you to be able to be a part of a creative street protest, maybe, or a college student event, or maybe a school awareness program, or a volunteer training program that we keep organizing. We keep organizing at a regular interval. So, yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
Nice. Well, yeah, I think that's all of our questions. Yeah, thank you so much, Nikunj, for joining us. It's been super interesting and useful to hear more about your work and in general the context of the animal advocacy movement in India. So yeah, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you. It was a pleasure and it was lovely talking, meeting, seeing both of you.